carries out fresh airstrikes on Khan Yunis and other parts of the Gaza Strip. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes, including malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases in Yemen. Also ahead, anti-vaccination protesters stormed the London headquarters of ITN broadcasters to show their anger at the British media bias. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Israeli warplanes have carried out a series of fresh airstrikes against different locations across the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, we were joined by our Gaza correspondent, who gave us more details about the latest Israeli attacks.
After the breaking news just minutes ago, Israeli fighter jets attacked two other locations in the besieged enclave. The latest one was in the east of Gaza City, Zaytun neighborhood. They targeted farmland there, causing damage to agricultural areas. And they also attacked south of Gaza City. And earlier, as regarding the breaking news, that was five attacks on a Hamas security training center west of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, causing extensive damage to that place and also to surrounding areas. Over the last few days, the Israeli regime has been attacking the Gaza Strip using drones, F-35 fighter jets and F-16 fighter jets to target Hamas security posts, because the Israeli regime blames Hamas for the peaceful protests that took place on Friday, marking the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the 52nd anniversary of the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by an Australian Zionist extremist.
At least one civilian has been killed in Saudi Arabia's shelling of a border region of Yemen's Sa'dah province. Yemeni media say another Yemeni civilian was injured in the Saudi attack. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015, tens of thousands of Yemenis, many of them women and children, have been killed in the kingdom's onslaught. Riyadh is still defying calls by the United Nations and rights groups to halt its cross-border aerial and ground attacks on the impoverished nation. And the UN official has warned that 5 million Yemenis are one step away from famine. He has called for more aid from donors to avert famine in the impoverished nation. We earlier discussed the issue in our news review program. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator has warned that 5 million Yemenis are one step away from famine. Martin Griffiths called for increasing aid from donors to avert a famine in Yemen. He added that more than 20 million people in the impoverished nation need humanitarian assistance. Meanwhile, the UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from preventable causes, including malnutrition and vaccine-preventable diseases. The UN has already said Yemen is experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has been caused by a Saudi-led war that began in March 2015 and a simultaneous blockade on the country. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them women and children. So joining us is Abdul Latif Al-Washali. He's our correspondent in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And we also have Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Abdul Latif, if I could start with you. Tell us about the latest situation in Yemen, the crisis unfolding there. What's the situation at Hodeidah Port? Are the fuel tankers Are they being have they been docked at the port that's vital to the lives of Yemenis?
Thank you, Wissam. The humanitarian situation of the country is really catastrophic due to the main issue here, which is the blockade. The United Nations realizes that millions of Yemenis are on the brink of famine and they need assistance, as the world body said. But what Yemenis believe is that what the United Nations is doing is a clear mendicity. They are begging the donor countries on behalf of the Yemeni people. Yemenis say what they need is the blockade to be lifted and a real measures against the Saudi coalition to stop its deadly war, to lift the blockade, and Yemenis are able to manage themselves, and they don't need any more funds from the donor countries. They believe, Yemeni people, that the funds are for the operational expenses of the United Nations organizations. Most of the funds goes for the employees of the organizations, and what reaches the people in need is really nothing. They are nothing compared to what they get from these funds. So Yemeni people are asking the United Nations and the international community to take real measures against Saudi Arabia and to pressure the Saudi coalition to lift the siege and stop asking on behalf of the Yemeni people for more funds.
Edward, so when you hear one Yemeni child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes as a result of aid not coming in, if that was one French child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, or one Canadian child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, or one American child or one British child dying every 10 minutes from preventable causes, will the aid then come and flow in?
Well, certainly, you know, if it was a white child, or, you know, from North America or somebody from Europe, there would be a much different response from the powerful Western countries, because it's Yemen. Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world, and it is, you know, not of concern, at least from a humanitarian point of view. The UN official, I think, described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. She should have added the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. So it's the blockade of Yemen that is the problem, which the Saudis and their allies, but also with help from the Americans and the British, have basically put in almost suffocating Yemen. They're only getting a tiny percentage of the fuel that they need. The World Health Organization has just canceled their medical program because, quote unquote, financial reasons, they're not getting the support. But, you know, the Hodeidah port could be open. If the Saudis are concerned about weapons and stuff coming through, the UN could monitor that and check it. But you need to open up the borders, allow food to enter, you know, from the Hodeidah port and any other port, but also from Oman and, you know, other places where, you know, the Sana'a airport could be opened up as well, especially for emergency medical reasons, or for bringing in vaccines, bringing in other medical supplies which are urgently needed. So yes, there's a double standard here. These are, you know, Arab Muslim individuals, Shia for the most part, and, you know, the world actually, it just turns a deaf ear, especially the rich countries that are not interested, but actually are interested in making money by selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and of course providing, you know, other military assistance. And in fact, the British now have sent in troops into Yemen, which is a very dangerous development. Britain used to have Yemen as a colony and trying to reestablish themselves there, and they're claiming that they're trying to hunt down the pirates, people who attacked an Israeli ship in the area. And, you know, this is possibly a false flag. They don't know who it is, or people trying to escalate the war and to create provocations or false flags to enable people to do that. So the British and even the American are looking for, you know, new places to wage war and to continue to fund its war machine. But the West, United Nations, The rich countries are actually not even turning a deaf ear, but actually are supporting the aggressors and the Saudis here, who have, you know, there's like over 20 million people on the verge of starvation, one child dying every 10 minutes. You've got millions on the verge of dying. And this is, you know, cruel, but it's a man-made crisis. There is, you know, no benefit other than that. I think the Saudis don't want to see a Shia government in Yemen, or a government that deals with the popular interests and looks after the people, as opposed to just, you know, the elite that is supported by the Saudis. So, you know, it's maybe that is the reason why this, the people of Saudi Arabia, the government there, is so opposed to Yemen being an independent state. The people are largely they speak the same language, share the same religion, but there is still this fear of maybe an example that the people of Yemen could control their own fate, and that's something that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and that don't want that message or that example to succeed.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guest, Abdul Latif Al-Washari, is our correspondent, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. And that wraps up this edition of the News Review. Syrian army has reportedly carried out an operation to retake the last stronghold of Western-backed militants in the country's south. Army sources said the operation is aimed at taking control over an enclave held by militants for years in the border city of Daraa. They said the military units have encircled the enclave and are trying to advance into the area. The army has also opened a corridor for civilians to leave. There was no indication of civilians, but reports say Moscow is trying to convince the militants to leave and avert a fight. The operation came a day after remnants of the terrorist groups reportedly fired rockets into some nearby buildings and damaged them. The Syrian army retook control of the province, of which Daraa is the capital, in 2018. One week after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, the city's main airport is still the scene of chaos, where thousands of people rushing to Kabul International Airport to flee the country. Tens of women, people, including women and children, have been killed in the chaotic situation so far. Amin Alami reports.
The situation in the Afghan capital Kabul is getting worse as a big chaos is ongoing in and around Kabul International Airport.
Just a few hundred meters behind me, there is Kabul International Airport, and thousands of people have gathered here to take a flight and flee the country. But both the Taliban and American forces who are stationed here do not allow the people to enter.
Thousands of Afghans rushed to Kabul International Airport only a day after Taliban took control of the capital Kabul almost a week ago.
This is a tragedy for every single Afghan national. The U.S. claims that it has spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. No, they were not after making good governance system in our country. They were only after imposing the current situation on our people and Afghanistan.
Chaos in Kabul airport has so far resulted in the death of at least 20 Afghans, including women and children. The horrifying situation in and around Kabul International Airport has created a big chaos.
People had heard something about the evacuation of Afghan nationals by the U.S. and other foreign troops from Kabul International Airport. So thousands of them gathered around the airport to get into it. But it was just a rumor, because even many passport holders couldn't get into the airport.
This comes as the Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for failing to bring the situation under control in the airport, an issue that, according to the Taliban, has led to the loss of civilian lives. Syed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Anti-vaccination protesters in the UK have gathered around the building of one of the country's largest television news outlets to show their anger at the British media bias. The protest was held at the headquarters of the news broadcaster ITN in central London. The protesters said the mainstream media are not reporting on what they claim are the adverse effects of COVID-19 vaccine. At one point, a number of demonstrators entered the lobby of ITN building, but police forcibly removed them. The ITN said the abuse of journalists because of their reporting on the coronavirus is a worrying development. Britain has been one of the worst hit European countries by the virus, with a record of over 131,000 deaths. Health officials say the country's vaccination program has saved around 95,000 lives. Our London correspondent Saeed Poreza joined us earlier with a rundown of the British protesters' demands.
What these individuals are calling for is they want to have a weekly briefing of the side effects, if any, of the vaccines for COVID-19. And also, they are protesting what is referred to as vaccine passports, which basically was introduced to demonstrate vaccine status, to be able to travel, to get into stadia, and a host of other places. Again, what they have been doing is really making those demands. What they believe is that the media is not really telling the people what they believe is their version of the truth about the vaccine, as well as the number of people who have died of the virus. It is important to say that some of these anti-vaxxers have actually passed away as a result of coming down with COVID.
Brazilian firefighters are racing against time to put out the blazes burning in the state of Sao Paulo. Fire crews have been fighting flames at Jacareí State Park for the past few days. A hot air balloon crash is said to have started the fires. Local officials say a combination of dry weather and a recent heat wave caused the fire to spread quickly. More than 1,200 hectares of land have been burnt so far, and three fires are still active. Firefighters say putting out the blazes is particularly hard, as water tankers are unable to reach some parts of the park itself. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight. The criticisms against U.S. President Joe Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan are coming from all corners, but most are missing the point. We now present you an article written by Sonali Kolhatkar, the founder, host, and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, a television and radio show that airs on Free Speech TV and Pacifica stations. The piece is titled Latest U.S. Misstep in Afghanistan, Just One of Many. The article was produced by Economy for All, a project of the Independent Media Institute, which provided it to Asia Times. U.S. President Joe Biden is under a tremendous amount of pressure from his own Democratic Party and the liberal media establishment for daring to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan and allowing the country to fall back into the hands of Taliban militants. Biden, in a statement on 14th of August, said, "One more year or five more years of U.S. military presence would not have made a difference if the Afghan military cannot or will not hold its own country." Just 2 days later, after the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled and the Taliban stormed into the capital, Kabul, Joe Biden, in a speech from the White House, defiantly maintained that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces, but was forced to admit that the Taliban resumed control of Afghanistan more quickly than we had anticipated. U.S. Republicans predictably jumped on this demonstrable foreign policy failure, neglecting to mention that it was Joe Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, who laid the groundwork for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and worked with the Taliban to do so. U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expostulated, "This debacle was not only foreseeable, it was foreseen," as if Donald Trump would have done any better as a second-term president. Trump's former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in an interview on Fox News Channel with Chris Wallace, chimed in, saying, "It looks like the Biden administration has just failed in its execution of its own plan, even though, of course, the Democratic president was in essence carrying out Donald Trump's plan." The Republican National Committee has now deleted a page on its website that had celebrated Donald Trump's dealings with the Taliban, perhaps hoping no one would notice. Corporate media were equally unforgiving of Joe Biden. The Washington Post editorial board issued a scathing opinion blaming Biden for any future deaths, saying that the U.S. assumed responsibility for all Afghans. Leaving them now means walking away from that responsibility. The Washington Post also worried about America's global prestige, saying, "At risk is the United States' reputation as a partner, as would-be allies around the world watch and calculate the value of an American commitment." In a similar vein, the New York Times' Brett Stevens demanded to know what on earth was Joe Biden thinking, if that is, he was thinking. Like the Washington Post, Stevens was deeply concerned about the nation's reputation, asking, "What kind of ally is the United States?" Such criticism missed several glaring points. First, if a foreign military occupation made no progress towards the so-called democracy and human rights in 20 years, it is unlikely to do so in 20 more years. Second, they are more concerned about the United States' reputation as a global superpower, which is what the term ally really implies, than human lives. And third, although some of Americans once supported the Afghanistan war and occupation, today, most Americans want the occupation to end. Moreover, most critics of Joe Biden's botched exit from Afghanistan appear to have missed the fact that the entirety of the occupation has been flawed and led to the debacle of the Taliban's resurgence. Biden's missteps were apropos of the entire occupation. Every step of the way, the United States made the wrong choice, regardless of which president, Republican or Democrat, was in power, from George W. Bush's decision to work with corrupt and violent warlords, to Barack Obama's choice to validate the Taliban by being the first to engage in peace talks with the Taliban militants. Joe Biden's fellow Democrats also joined in the criticism against him, but got much closer to the questions that really need to be asked about the disastrous turn of events in Afghanistan. Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said, "I'm disappointed that the Biden administration clearly did not accurately assess the implications of a rapid U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan." More importantly, he made the astute observation that we are now witnessing the horrifying results of many years of policy and intelligence failures. Even though the U.S.-backed Afghan government has been ineffectual and corrupt directly as a result of choices that successive U.S. administrations made over the years, the Biden administration could have chosen to coordinate more closely with the institution, if only to ensure that billions of dollars worth of U.S.-bought weapons would not fall into Taliban hands. Instead, according to the Associated Press, the ultimate beneficiary of the American investment in Afghanistan's military turned out to be the Taliban, who grabbed not only political power, but also U.S.-supplied firepower, guns, ammunition, helicopters, and much more. To summarize, the U.S. went to war against Afghanistan in October of 2001 in order to supposedly punish the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for the suspicious September 11 attacks, spent nearly two decades fighting the so-called war on terror, and ended up leaving its ostensible enemy empowered both politically and militarily. American taxpayers who naively backed the invasion and occupation spent trillions of dollars in a brutal decades-long exercise in futility that resulted in lost lives, a traumatized Afghan population, and a renewal of forces that terrorized them. The Taliban couldn't have asked for a better war. It may be hard to believe that things could have been even worse under Donald Trump, but if the former Republican president were in power now, it is likely we would be witnessing a similar situation, but with even more violence. Mike Pompeo, in his Fox News Channel interview, advised the Biden administration to crush these Taliban who are surrounding Kabul, adding, "We should do it with American air power. We should put pressure on them. We should inflict cost and pain on them." Past wars have demonstrated with striking reliability that such infliction of pain is never precise and always result in so-called collateral damage, a euphemism for civilian casualties. Donald Trump had a proven penchant for using massive firepower with no regard for civilians, and with Mike Pompeo offering him advice, we would likely have seen the same situation as we're seeing today, but with the added horror of bombs falling on people attempting to flee the Taliban. The Taliban's takeover of Kabul is being likened by many to the fall of Saigon. Before the Afghanistan war, there was the Vietnam War, and there were many other wars during and before Vietnam and Afghanistan that garnered less attention. If there is a lesson that Americans, as a nation, ought to take away from these devastating militaristic exercises that consistently do more harm than good, it is to ensure we never again rally behind the desire to bomb, raid, occupy, and militarily strike another nation. This means standing up to the liberal and conservative establishments that find a detached comfort in the cold calculus of warfare with no concern for life, no concern for safety or democracy.
English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, since this is the month of Muharram, and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. Let's get to the most harsh event of the history.
Yeah.
That is the tragic event of Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yeah, Muawiyah, the notorious Muawiyah, selected his son, the playboy, the womanizer, the guy who was always drunk.
The true profligate.
The profligate. A man who did profane. A man who attacked Kaaba. Who attacked Kaaba, man? During the history. Who attacked Kaaba? The house of Allah. Yazid did that. So see how much notorious and how much corrupted a person could be. I do want to say, do not look at the tragic event of Karbala and killing of Imam al-Hussein. He did not do mercy toward Kaaba, the house of Allah. Some people say, okay, the atrocity toward Imam al-Hussein was this and that. He attacked Kaaba. He demolished it, man. At the time of Abdullah ibn Zubair, it was. He was the governor of that time. Of course, they had their own problems too. We do not confirm them or we do not approve them. But brother, Yazid got the power. And even when you ask some of our Sunni brethren about Yazid, they are embarrassed. Say, okay, this he was a disgrace to the whole, we can say, Muslim Ummah. And we are sorry that Yazid was selected as the next successor and king to the Muslim power on that time. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam cannot tolerate Brother Ali al-Abiyan.
Yeah.
It starts his movement and uprises against Yazid. Now, talk up a little bit about the roots for us.
Actually, when this priest treaty that Imam Hassan al-Islam wrote with Muawiyah, we read it, we see that among one of these conditions that we referred to earlier, it was said that the successorship should not be at the hand of Muawiyah, rather it has to be at the hand of Imam Hassan, and it has to actually continue in the right way that it was mentioned. Okay, Muawiyah did not accept this condition, and as doctor said, he tore it in front of people, and he said, I just wanted to take the power. And the expediency of the Islamic Ummah, the few number of Muslims at the time of Imam Hassan who were supposed to help him, because, you know, the loyal companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Hassan, some of them were martyred in Nahrawan, some in Safin, some in recent battles at that time, close to his father time, and so he had very few people with him. And even when he signed the treaty with Muawiyah, some of the even close companions of Imam actually criticized him of why have you signed this treaty. So I wanted to to portray
the situation
of the time.
Yes.
So anyhow, he took the power against whatever was agreed earlier.
You mean Yazid?
Yazid, yeah. Yes. Muawiyah selected his son against whatever has been agreed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So he appointed him as the leader of the Islamic Ummah. And it's beautiful for us to know that even the Prophet actually has predicted such scenes that in a dream that he saw monkeys are climbing and going up off the member of the Holy Prophet.
Of the and Rasulullah,
he was embarrassed of this dream. And it is said that in this hadith that after that dream, no one saw the Prophet even smiling till that time of his.
Let me claim the references.
Yeah.
From the Shia side, Sheikh Al-Tusi and Muhaddis Bahrani, and from our family brethren, Suyuti and Alusi, have narrated the great narration of Prophet Muhammad in reference to...
Its interpretation, it comes as it refers to this event.
Event, yes. That's right. And this Shajaratul Mal'una, which is the cursed...
The accursed dynasty.
Dynasty, or the accursed family tree, as they say. This is Surah Isra, Ayah 60. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam could not tolerate Yazid. Nobody could.
Look, Imam Hussein, when he saw, even based on the treaty that was written and was signed from two sides, he knew that it's his own right to take the leadership of the Islamic Ummah.
Okay.
But the other side, that is Yazid, is asking him to come and pay allegiance to me. And Imam tells him, a person like me never actually pays allegiance with a person like you.
That's right.
So this is the starting point of this, actually... quarrel, which leads to Imam's going, and he wants, and Yazid wants the governor of Medina to force Imam Hussein alayhi salam to accept the allegiance.
Al-Khalafatu Muharrama ala Abi Sufyan. This is the narration of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam narrating.
This is a prophetic hadith.
No, I know. This is what Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam quoted
from
Prophet Muhammad.
Yes.
That any type of authority or authorship is forbidden for Ala Abi Sufyan, that is the dynasty.
And
okay.
It is sad, brother, that some even Muslim brothers think that Imam did khuruj, actually exited from the Islamic, paying allegiance to the Islamic leader.
No, he was embracing Islam.
So now, no, since he left the Mecca, since he left Medina towards Mecca and then towards Kufa, towards. Karbala. They said, so some extremists in Islamic denominations actually believe that Imam did khuruj. Why did he leave the allegiance of the Islamic leader is Yazid.
So
we have to say that when you believe that it is your right to lead the Islamic Ummah, is there any other document argument that or any the reason that makes you to not accept your duty?
And Brother Ali, believe me, Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not did khuruj for his power and for his own right. It was for the islah, for the correction of the Ummah of Rasulullah that was deviated and very much corrupted by a notorious man, a king, a man who was famous for his scandals here and there. In the Muslim Ummah, a man who was playing with the animals, the dogs and the monkeys, all of them are documented, brothers and sisters. Muslims around the world, go and check who was Yazid ibn Muawiyah, Yazid son of Muawiyah. How notorious this guy was and how much he selected his governors here and there in the Muslim lands.
For a person
who... the corruption and the facade that he did.
For a person who is a duty bound, acting based on his duty and whatever is on his shoulder is actually sort of ibadah. So Imam, when he thinks and when he sees that it is his turn to be leading the Islamic Ummah and seizes a duty, so he leaves Medina as a sign of his disagreement with whatever is going to be forced against him.
But thank you much, Brother Ali Levian.
Yeah,
you want to continue?
Just one more sentence.
Just one more sentence.
So
okay.
Imam leaves Medina towards Mecca, and then from that, when he sees that there is a sort of, let's say, welcoming of Imam in Karbala, in Kufa, so he wants to respond to whatever has come towards him, that is the people's acceptance. Because a part of a government, an Islamic government based on our worldview, is that besides Allah's appointment, you need people's acceptance as well.
Yes.
So he finds that more than 120,000 letters and comes towards Imam and asks and invites Imam to come to lead over us in Kufa. That's why Imam leaves even Hajj uncompleted and goes towards Kaaba.
But Dr. Farhani, Yazid and his governors here and there in Medina and Mecca tried very much to take allegiance from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam by words and by swords, both of them. What's your take on that, brother? Were they successful?
No, never.
So how many times they tried to do so?
Well, actually, Yazid, and I mean, first Muawiya and then Yazid, and the agents in
agents
the Arabia,
of Yazid,
yes,
in Mecca, yes.
They were very much concerned about Imam al-Hussein's, I mean, accepting or recognizing Yazid. Please note well that after the martyrdom of the second infallible Imam, al-Hasan al-Mujtaba, alayhi salam, when Muawiya used to go to Arabia, I mean, presumably, on pilgrimage, but definitely for other purposes, Muawiya tried hard to obtain the recognition of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and in a couple of times at Medina and Mecca, Muawiya said that there's no barrier for me on my way except Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who never recognizes my son Yazid as the next successor or my successor.
And this is the last will and testament of Muawiya to Yazid?
No, it wasn't.
They say that Muawiya, in the last moments of his life, warned Yazid about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
This is documented.
Yes, this is well documented. But in fact, we find that, I mean, the reign of Muawiya was really a reign of, I mean, terror and oppression on people.
Okay.
And at the same time, we find that those people, I mean, who were very much attached to the house of the Ahl al-Bayt from al-Kufa, or some of them from the Levant, used to come to Medina in order to meet up with Imam al-Hussein al-Salam.
That's right.
While Muawiyah was in power. And this threatened Muawiyah very much, because Muawiyah felt that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam had already become a very attractive figure in Medina. This is why after the death of Muawiyah, we find that Yazid dispatches orders his agents in Medina to exert all sorts of pressures on Imam al-Hussein al-Salam, because the Umayyad dynasty knew well that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam wasn't, an easy problem to be wiped out. I mean, he was a real barrier, okay? And because of the significance of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam as the last member of the Ahl al-Bayt, to whom the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam directly, pointed out, we find that the Umayyad dynasty knew well that next to Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, the bigger problem was Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who never showed any sign of compromise with them. This is why we find that after Muawiyah, Yazid spared no efforts in order to exert all sorts of pressures on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the rest of the Hashimites, because he knew well that, the Hashimites, were not such people to accept any kind of pressure or any kind of tyranny, and they had their own right path, coupled with the point that the righteous people in the Muslim lands, especially the true Shiites, whatever they were, they were not potential, but the actual supporters of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam and the rest of descendants of Imam Ali al-Salam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani and Brother Ali al-Abiyan.
Thanks to you, brother.
For your presence in the program Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. May Allah accept all of our mournings and azadaris and this majalis that we do for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the man who said no to the oppression of Yazid ibn Muawiyah and wanted to revive the pure Muhammadan Islam. For more information on this program, visit our website, parstoday.com/Yankalav Islam page. Do not forget us in these supplications and the morning ceremonies and the rallies and demonstrations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the months of Muharram all across the world. Take care, the pandemic is killing, but held your ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, even if it is online. Brothers, do not forget that these sha'ir and the rituals has to be enlivened, even if they are digital and online. Do your marasim and majalis and takaya for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. May Allah bless you all. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
Look here, Zahra.
Look here, Zahra. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison insists Australia can reopen once vaccination targets hit, but some state leaders aren't so sure. We're prepared for you an article written by Sarah Martin. Under the heading, Morrison facing state resistance over reopening plan as New South Wales COVID crisis worsens. The article was published by the Australian Associated Press News Agency. Are continuing to push back against the terms of a nationally agreed plan to open up the country once vaccination rates hit 70% and 80%, warning the worsening COVID crisis in New South Wales could yet be a deal-breaker. As a pared-down federal parliament prepares to sit in Canberra amid the Australian Capital Territory's lockdown, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is insisting that growing case numbers are not a reason to abandon the national plan agreed to by all states and territories. Under the four-phase strategy signed off in July and based on modeling from the Doherty Institute, restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of the disease are relaxed once 70% of Australians aged over 16 are vaccinated, with stringent lockdowns unlikely to be required at this stage. Once vaccination coverage reaches 80%, only highly targeted lockdowns would be necessary, and vaccinated Australians would be free to travel interstate. National Cabinet has requested updated advice from the Doherty Institute that takes into account the current caseload, which jumped by 917 on Sunday, 22nd of August. But Prime Minister Scott Morrison insisted that the outcome would remain the same. Morrison told the ABC's Insider program, "The starting point doesn't ultimately change the ultimate conclusion point of where case numbers arrive." Adding, "As we go forward, once you get over 70% and particularly over 80%, lockdowns do more harm than good." Scott Morrison added, "Lockdowns are not a sustainable way to deal with the virus, and that's why we have to get to the 70% and 80% marks so we can start living with the virus." After recent National Cabinet meetings, Scott Morrison warned state and territory leaders not to abandon the commitment made to the Australian people to ease restrictions, while the Treasurer, Jos Frydenberg, has said the Commonwealth won't financially support the states locking down once vaccination targets are reached. However, on Sunday, 22nd of August, the Queensland Deputy Premier, Stephen Miles, said the states had agreed to the national plan before the New South Wales outbreak, and Queensland could still close the border to New South Wales even when vaccination rates reach 80%. Queensland Deputy Premier Stephen Miles said about the potential border closures, he said, "We may, it will depend on the situation here and the situation in New South Wales," adding, "We're signed up and committed to the plan that National Cabinet endorsed, but that was a plan that was endorsed before the New South Wales outbreak." The Premier of Western Australia, Mark McGowan, also cast doubt on whether Western Australia would be prepared to abandon its elimination strategy, saying the state wanted to continue to try to crush and kill the virus. He also said that lockdowns could still be used by states and territories to contain the spread of the virus under the agreement signed off by the states. Western Australia Premier Mark McGowan also said, "I think what's happening in New South Wales is obviously tragic and very difficult for the people there, but there's an Australia outside of New South Wales, and we're all doing our best to keep the virus out, and we're following the national plan." Mark McGowan noted, "Queensland, Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, we're all pretty much now COVID-free. Victoria is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus using measures that have been proven to work." He added, "The Act is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus. New Zealand is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus. It's only New South Wales that is not. They're letting down the entire country." Mark McGowan added, "It is very, very debilitating for the Federation and for everyone else that's trying to do the right thing." However, the Chief Medical Officer, Professor Paul Kelly, said there was no jurisdiction in the world that had eliminated COVID-19, with the Delta strain now also upending the New Zealand government's success to date with the virus. Professor Paul Kelly added, "Western Australia have done extremely well up to now, mostly relying on the very strong border controls, both external to the rest of the world and to the rest of Australia. Professor Paul Kelly added, "The matters of how Western Australia see themselves working through the pandemic over time is really a matter for them. But I will say that the whole of the National Cabinet, including the West Australian Premier, did sign up to the plan only a couple of weeks ago." The Doherty Institute Director of Epidemiology, Professor Jody McVernon, also said pursuing a COVID-zero strategy would be difficult with the Delta strain of the virus. Professor McVernon added, "We have seen how contagious this virus is. We have seen how difficult it is to keep it out. And even in jurisdictions that have had highly effective public health responses and contained outbreaks, it has been getting away." The Labour leader, Anthony Albanese, said the Doherty Institute modelling had not advised that the country could reopen once the vaccination target was reached with hundreds of active cases. He said if the Prime Minister had information that showed rising case numbers need not impact our plan to reopen, then he needs to release that advice. Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese said, "No one wants to be locked down for a day more than necessary." Labour is expected to continue its assault on the government over the vaccine rollout when Parliament sits in the coming days, having said half the country would not be in lockdown if the Morrison government had secured more vaccines earlier. Fewer than 50 MPs are expected to sit in the House of Representatives, and the Senate chamber is expected to be half empty under strict conditions governing the final two sitting weeks of the current session. The merit of Australia's 20-year mission in Afghanistan is expected to be debated in the lower house of the parliament, while the government has prioritised national security laws, disability support reform, and changes to the way elections are run on its legislation programme.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.